No, Thiago Silva is going to take up most of the pad, I feel.
It is not.
Oh, come on. We've spent entire pods talking about Cole Palmer.
It's warranted.
Thiago Silva, club legend.
That's a debate. It absolutely is a debate.
Well, before we decide if that's a debate, where do you stand on that?
I don't know.
Okay.
I have.
I put him below the tier of legend.
I do right now, and the only criteria that puts him there is tenure. That's
4 years.
it. Yeah. That's the only criteria that puts him there. Everything else checks the box for me, but I think of it that Chelsea has their wall of legends. Said that before, and I don't think he'll be there. I
Yeah.
wouldn't be surprised though if he did. Like, if he did show up, I wouldn't be surprised, but I don't think he's going to get there. I don't think he gets a plaque. Those are club legends to me.
Yeah, I saw he was. Apparently, he's been working on his B license. I don't know what the different licenses are in Europe, but, allows holders to be head coaches of men's amateur clubs and youth teams up to 16 and assistant coaches for professional clubs. So apparently he's been working on that.
Interesting.
I would be interested to see if there's a change in management if he comes on as an assistant. I know he wants to play 1 year in Brazil or whatever, but
Yeah. I want to see a list of the players that are hot, that have plaques outside Stamford Bridge. This is as of 19 when Tambling got honored.
okay.
And so in the article, it references Chelsea's shed wall now features 17 legends. They are in alphabetical order: Peter Benetti, Petr Cech, Ashley Cole, Marcel Desailly, Kerry Dixon, Didier Drogba, Ron Harris, Jimmy Floyd Hasselbaink, Branislav Ivanovic, Frank Lampard, Peter Osgood, Bobby Tambling, John Terry, Gianluca Vialli, Ray Wilkins, Dennis Wise, Gianfranco Zola.
He doesn't make that for me, if
Me
that's the
either.
criteria.
That's legend. That's the class of legend, and I think that's the bar that Chelsea holds the word legend to, because they call them legends.
Yes.
He's the class below that.
Yes.
That's my argument. Like,
Yeah. So John Terry is in there, right?
yes.
I wonder. So FB Ref, that's the club I use for all, or the thing I use for all stats and whatnot. They let you do player comparisons. I wonder if I could do a comparison. Silva and John Terry.
I mean, he might be a better player, but like,
Well,
he's
I
a
mean, just
PSG legend, right?
yeah, but I mean, like, just based off of, you know, 4 year sample size.
Sure. Because like, he played for PSG for like, I
Eight
don't know,
years.
I was gonna say 9 years. So I think he's like the longest tenured captain in PSG history. Like, PSG legend.
Yeah. But you don't see him, and maybe it's just because I don't follow a lot of PSG accounts, but you don't see him get the same kind of love. It doesn't seem like he has the same connection with Paris as he does with London and Chelsea.
I feel like he loves London and London loved him back, and it was a very harmonious relationship, and he wants to live here long term. His kids play for the club. There's a lot of things about Chelsea that he embodies. Just, I mean, if you want to throw names like Thiago Silva, you're going to laugh. This is probably a better off the cuff pod question to throw at you. Is Marcus Alonso a club legend?
Ooh.
The
Ooh.
answer to that's no.
Okay. Yeah, when you take the name out of it, that's all right. So John Terry's last year was age 35. That Thiago Silva's first year with us was age 35. I'm gonna
Hilarious.
compare those. God, John Terry played 9 matches that year. So that's not a good comparison. Mean, that's the thing with Thiago Silva, though, is goddamn, he's 38. Most people who are 38 are in the media at that point.
He played a shit ton at 37, 38. He played less as a 39-year-old, sure, but like he played a lot as a 36, 37, 38-year-old, which I give him a ton of credit for, because they even said it in the broadcast, in the Villa broadcast. They said, "I still think Thiago Silva makes your best 11 for Chelsea." They brought it up. Their argument is their idea of center back pairings is one experienced, one younger. And, because of that, like a De Sassi and Silva or a Colwell Silva, whatever pairing is your best bet.
Man.
I know.
Yeah, he's played, I mean, he'll pass 2300 minutes this year, but just league minutes alone, he's played 2300 minutes 3 out of the 4 years he's been here. Age 36, 37, 38, 39.
It's amazing. What he's done is nothing short of amazing.
Well, oh God, this is another episode where we started the episode before we did the intro. Welcome to the Flag Stays Down podcast. The flag stays down. Thiago Silva, is his success here more of a reflection on Chelsea or on him? You can put. And I don't want to call Thiago Silva average. I'm not disrespecting him, but you can put an average guy into a shitty squad and he'll succeed and look real good. We finished 4th, 3rd, 12th, and now we're 8th, 9th, 10th, somewhere in there this year. Is
He
it
was.
because the squad is shitty, or is it because he's still good at the age of 39?
I think part of that's true. And I think part of why Cole Palmer has stood as this shining beacon light is because the rest of the squad has underperformed, which has allowed us to focus in on the one bright spot that we've had. I think Silva does a little bit of that. But if he was just as a 38, 39-year-old, you'd have the full argument for me. But he. Correct me if I'm wrong, he played in that Champions League final. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So he was the starting center back in a Champions League final for Chelsea on one of our best days in club history. That team was not average. That team was not bad. That team was quite good. And he was, you look at the stats of that year and the goals in versus goals scored, both numbers were a hell of a lot lower, right? Like he was the captain of that defense to help us keep many, many, many clean sheets. I mean, those were the days, Collins, where we didn't know how a team was going to score against us. You remember those days?
Oh yeah, I'm just looking back, and they, not all leagues at all times, they take into account all stats, but he had a career high in tackles 2 years ago. He's had more tackles in 4 years and more challenges won in 4 years in England than he did the 4 years that they recorded it in France. And some of that is probably due to PSG dominating possession as much as they did, but we've done a pretty decent job of holding possession over the last 3 years.
We have, and we were hard to score against. So, and like even when we were not great, Silva stood out as either saving us in a lot of situations or still being that just solid rock. You know, there are many, many, many more times that we got together on a Sunday night and talked about how great he was than how bad he was or how average he was. It very, very far skews to the how great he was. So he did a lot for us.
Well, we've kind of shied away from it, but he was the namesake for our Man of the Match award, the Thiago Silva Memorial Match winner. He's been good, but I think the conversation boils down to, as we were alluding to earlier, club legend.
For me, sadly, no. And all of that to say, like, I love him. I love what he's done for us. I love what he's been for our club. His signing off message, the 4.5 minute clip that he recorded, was brilliant. And it just speaks to who he was as a person, who he is as a player, his family, his situation, his career, all the things that lead up to it, what means a lot to him. You know, it all comes through. The only criteria he does not have for me for club legend is longevity or tenure. Like, it's a 4-year career towards the end of his career. I think he's got a shot at becoming a legend on the managerial side, or like in the back office side, potentially down the road, as part, like, you know, his story is not done yet. But as a player, he's not at the level that Chelsea holds the word legend to. And Chelsea's a big club that's been around for a long time, and they've had legends at the club. And I don't think they throw that word around lightly. I know English sports and teams don't retire jerseys the same way that American sports do, and retire and have like a Hall of Fame kind of a thing. That's sort of saved for legendary status, right? Like, that's, it's only the best of the best that kind of get to that level for a club or a team. And if they were retiring jerseys, I don't think Thiago Silva's would be retired. He's going to have very fond memories about him. He's going to be that tier right below legend for me, but he's just doesn't make it because he didn't spend the majority of his career, or, you know, an 8 to 10 year kind of a period with the club. Sucks to say it, but that's where I sit on it.
No, and I think if you zoom out and look at his work as a whole across his career, I think he is a legendary defender in the game. You know, he only spent 3 years at AC Milan, but he was the best center back in the planet in those 3 years. Went to PSG, he was there for 8 years, and, you know, I don't think he gets the accolades he deserves from that time, but he was very good there. And then 4 years here at Chelsea, which, again, he was great. And I think he fits more. You made the Marcus Alonso comparison. I don't like that one. He's a step above Marcus Alonso. I would put him in almost like the Juan Mata, Nemanja Matic kind of fold. Maybe just below a Branislav Ivanovic. But it would be for exactly what you said, and that's the longevity. You know, Ivanovic, I think, was here 6, 7 years. Won multiple titles, all that. Thiago certainly has the silverware here, but yeah, 4 years and not being a captain in those 4 years, I think, also kind of hurts him too. But again, not to take away from him, he's been fantastic, and he's in that second tier, but he, to me, very clearly not in that legendary tier.
Yeah, don't forget too, he's been a big part of the Brazil team, a Brazil team that hasn't seen World Cup success, but has basically won everything else too. You know, I think his mark on the game is way beyond his impact at Chelsea. He's going to be remembered as a fantastic defender throughout the different leagues that he's played in, and overall great teammate, overall just a solid person, teacher, mentor kind of a guy, and someone who, you know, I've seen a fair amount of his highlights over the past couple of days on social media, and his hustle to clear balls off the final line where he's not even on the camera by the time they start the clip, and there's other Chelsea defenders that are, he's out hustling those guys to clear the ball, man. It's highlights that make you smile, and when people break down his defending in kind of like reading people's minds. Those are the clips where you're just like, he is a student of his game. He's a master of his craft, and he's a great role model. We need more people like Thiago Silva in today's game, man. It's sad to see him go. I understand it totally, 100%. It's his time to go, but he'll be missed.
So he did say he was coming to London for 1 year, planning on 1 year, ended up saying four. The word is that he wants to play 1 year in Brazil to finish out his career, but who knows if that turns into four. He is apparently working on his UEFA Class B license for coaching, which allows him to coach up through U16s or be an assistant. When he's done in Brazil, maybe a year or so, do you bring him back in any fold or in any way into the fold?
I mean, it sounds like he wants to be in London. His kids play for the club. He likes being in West London. He's got a place here. I don't see why not. I mean, we've had our fair share of former players, you know, try their hand at coaching to varying degrees of success. But, as a defensive coach, not the guy that I don't think full-time manager, I don't think like that's probably suited for him today. But as a positions coach, I think he's been a great locker room guy. He's been a great presence, and he's been a motivator of talent. So he's clearly demonstrated that he can walk the walk. And I think he's also helped shape our young defense as well. So I don't see why not. I really don't. I think he's got a lot to give, and he's got a passion for the game that I think shines through. So I'd love to see him back. If he wants to be back, like I'd love to see him back. Those are the type of coaches that I think stand against the crowd, right? Where they want to be there. They want to help people along and take the next step.
I would love to see him come back and work with the academy. Right now he's again licensed to work with U16s and under. I wouldn't want him back as an assistant with the first team. That gets messy when you have a guy who played with the majority of the team. And assumingly a new head coach coming in as well, a little bit of undermining there. But, if he can come in and teach these 14, 15, 16-year-olds how to play like how he did, ooh, that's going to build that Cobham pipeline even further. So let him come back, let him work with the academy and, work on some further badges and let him move on up the ranks.
Yeah. And I think the best part of his teaching strategy is literally the mental side of the game, because it's about body positioning. It's about reading situations, about knowing where your opponent wants to go and then kind of taking things away. Right. I always thought of myself as probably being the world's worst volleyball coach in the world, because my advice to middles would be just jump higher. That's all I did. I wasn't very good. I just jumped higher than a lot of people. So I wouldn't make a very good coach, because positionally I wasn't as skilled as a lot of my fellow middles. But Thiago is the antithesis of that. He was not the most athletic. He was not the fastest. He was not, going to beat people in a foot race. But what he could do was read the game mentally, which is something that you can teach and pass on to those athletic people and then kind of give them an extra tool in their tool belt.
So I did see the injury he picked up. I don't know. I haven't read anything about it since then, but he left the game with a bit of a nagging injury. Do you think he features again for Chelsea? He's got to feature at least once at Stamford Bridge, even if it's a 5 minute cameo, right?
Yeah, I think it's a cameo. It's a send off or a guard of arms kind of a situation for him. I hope so. I hope he gets his flowers. Literally, when I texted the group about what tonight was going to be about, my number one on my list was give Thiago his flowers. And that's exactly what I think we should do as a club. We got to give him his flowers. He deserves a send-off, because while he might not have reached legendary status, as we talked about, he is right below it. And that is still rare air. That is still unoccupied space by a lot of people. There are a lot of players that we've talked about on this podcast that will not get to that level of accolade or affirmation from us and the general public. He deserves it. He absolutely deserves it, man.
I would love the John Terry-esque stop the game in the sixth minute and sub him off with the guard of honor. Now, obviously, you got to have the opposing team also buy in on that. But, no, that would be a fitting end to his career in Europe.
I feel like Silva's the type of dude, too, that you could get on board with that as an opposition to send him off in the 38th game of the season. I don't know who we play last, but if we could do that to stop the game for a minute, that would be wonderful.
And it's English referees, so they'll tack on zero extra minutes for that.
Oh, of course.
But hey, speaking of that, boy, it's been a rough couple weeks of officiating for Chelsea. You know, we were talking a little bit pre-pod about we were getting a lot of calls in the middle of the season, not so many in the beginning of the season. And now it seems like we're reverting back to the mean here and getting some rough no calls. What do you think?
It's bullshit. I mean, I actually was kicking myself for not bringing this up when we talked about the City match. That City handball was about as blatant as they get. So that sucks. And like I said, we didn't talk about it, but in a match where it's 0-0 for the majority of the game, that call makes a really big difference. The body of Shiel push off. The reason I'm upset by that is because I've seen things like that not get called a fair amount this year by Premier League refs. So I feel like it again comes down to a consistency thing. Do I think he pushed off? Yeah, I do. I think he pushed. But do I see that kind of coming together happen 150 times every Premier League match? Absolutely. When there's a contested header, like people come together. Like that's what you do, right? Like it's just that sort of motion and that sort of thing happens a lot. I don't think Body of Shield was trying to push him over. I thought he was going to get that same level of opposition and contest for that ball. Because if that defender goes at him with the same amount of force, nothing gets called because they kind of stalemate it, right? And I think he fell over and Body of Shield's kind of left holding the bag, right? So he sold it. It's fine. Not my favorite call in the world, but I guess definitely not my most shocked face call in the world. But I don't know, what do you make of it?
Seems like this year there's been a big push or pushback from the various referees associations about the spirit of the game. You know, not calling things by the book. You know, it depends on the situation in the game, right? There was the classic one in the Champions League where Gabriel against what was that again? Oh, that was against Tuchel and Bayern.
Yep.
The blatant handball on the restart by touching the ball. Referee doesn't call it. Plain as day, referee doesn't call it because it was spirit of the game, right?
I can't make that call in the Champions League sound, whatever it said, right? Like that was the quote by the ref.
Yep. And then you just look at the last two for Chelsea and FA Cup semifinal, 0-0 game. Shot driven into the wall and very clearly handball. And it wasn't like his arm was in a position that it should naturally be in. It came down, deflected the ball, I think twice, right? Off the shoulder and then off the arm, something like that. I don't know how you determine spirit of the game in that call. And then same in this one, you know, you're in the dying embers of the game. And like you said, a call that goes uncalled countless times throughout the year. And now you're going to enforce it. Why? I'm all for calling things within the spirit of the game. That's part of the joy of watching soccer. That was part of the joy of not having VAR. What was that, 10 years ago? Is that these things would happen? You'd say, all right, well, the ref's letting them play, or you know, something similar. But now that we have video review and it's high def, multiple angles, why is this being left up to individual, you know, thought, prejudices, things like that? It boggles my mind. I understand spirit of the game, but when it's a when it's a close game, when it's a game that's going to determine a lot of things in the table, why are we leaving that up to chance and opinion?
And I want to talk about the Villa more than I want to talk about the City. But the thing that really grinds my gears about the City one is that it was a goal kick. Like, they didn't even like reverse it to be a corner, like, which makes zero sense. So it feels like they flipped a coin backstage and it came up as goal kick, and that's what they got, right? So I'll leave that be. I'll kill that. We'll be done talking about that. That was a couple of weeks ago. For the Villa one, I just and I lost my train of thought of what I was going to say about the Villa one. Shoot. Blanking. Sorry.
Well, let me ask you non-Chelsea related, but in the similar vein. There was the Nottingham Forest Luton game last weekend, and there were apparently three missed calls against Luton. And Nottingham apparently had warned the Premier League match officials that, hey, your VAR guy's a Luton fan. I think it was Paul Winstanley, Winstanley, it's our sporting director, but you know who I'm talking about. Paul Tierney. Yeah. So Nottingham Forest comes out on social media and says, we're exploring our options. Like, we warned you, and this is, we're getting the short end of the stick. Premier League basically brushed that off, says, we'll investigate it. And the match officials say, oh, it's a dangerous road to go down. But is that how this gets fixed?
I don't know if that, I think people need to step up and say something, because that was a blatant, we warned you, and then this kind of thing came out. Also, I just read that Forest is launching an investigation on their own striker for match fixing, which is wild as well. So some crazy things happening with the Forest crew, but I think you have to kind of kick your feet a little bit and scream, because things aren't fair. And I don't think that anyone has sympathy for Chelsea because of the size of our club. The same thing happened to Liverpool though recently, where ball is live, keeper throws the ball out, ball is live, and then all of a sudden, no, ball's dead. Like, just some inconsistencies about some of the stuff. Just, and I'm not, playing the violin for Liverpool here, but like, just some of these like baffling decisions that just kind of leaves you scratching your head. We've been calling for more consistency throughout the life of this podcast. We've been calling for more consistency. We can live with bad as long as it's bad universally, and it doesn't feel like we're being kind of selected against. What I don't like is a game kind of falling to the depths of this. And what I was going to say about that Villa penalty call or no penalty call is, like, if that goes as a goal, I don't think a lot of people protest it, because he scored a goal, body of shield, wins the ball, crosses it in, a header was completed, goal scored. Like, you can argue the fact that he shouldn't have been able to get the ball there, but not a ton of people protest it. But the fact that it then gets brought back and called, like, that kind of tells you something. Like, that let them play should be kind of the default, and then stop where egregious should be the line. And that's where I think a lot of people think, like, you can't really interfere with a lot of those things. And to your point, like, spirit of the game, it's a game that Chelsea controlled a lot of. It's a game that, outside of really one true mishap in the first 5 minutes of the game, Chelsea really outplayed them. And again, they scored against the grain of competition twice. One was more legit than the other. The Cucurella on goal, pinball kind of in the box situation, was us falling asleep at the wheel in the first 5 minutes. Happens, but it's not fun. Outside of that, 97 odd other minutes, we dominated. We deserved to win that game. We really did.
And that was coming off a rough match where I predicted we would ruin Arsenal's title challenge. Could not have been further from the truth there. What differences did you see from a very shitty second half against Arsenal, a shitty overall match compared to the turnaround here against Villa.
Yeah, so I break it down into three sections. So follow me here. So the first 45 against Arsenal was okay. Not good. We conceded early, I think third minute, fourth minute, whatever it was. So meh to ish, bad, whatever. But like, we didn't play terrible in that first 45 against Arsenal. Second 45, we played terrible. It was uninspired. It was bad. It was ugly for a lot of reasons. And then the first 45 against Villa, also not great. We conceded twice. We did some better things. Nico scored and then got it called back, and he knew he was offside. So I think he can only do those chips or those dinks when he knows he's offside. He didn't celebrate that goal for a second. You know, talk about VAR ruining the game, because he knew that goal was getting called back for sure, man. So 45, not great to okay. 90, terrible to bad, like however you want to skin it. And then the 45 after that with Villa was great. It was inspired. We made a change tactically. We went to effective three at the back. Cucurella was an overloaded midfielder, and we changed the way we played, and we took it to him. It was exciting. It was dynamic. It was different. And I've said this a lot, and you know I've said this a lot, but I've wanted three at the back for a while with this team. I think we've got the squad to play three at the back better than we can with the four at the back that we have been. Because if we can overload that midfield, I think it does a lot for us. So Cucurella as a makeshift midfielder in this situation did pretty well. And, you know, we looked better. So it made me excited again. And we got two back, could have gotten three back. We were pretty close to snatching all 3 points against a Villa team that's sitting in what, fifth, sixth right now?
Yeah.
So yeah. Not bad.
Yeah, I have a similar sentiment to you, breaking it out into three sections. 100% agree with that. I did find the second half of the Arsenal match to be an interesting watch. It was weird, right? We concede goals. We don't concede goals like that, though. We talked about match fixing earlier. I'm not accusing anyone of match fixing here. But a good friend of the pod, Joe Mach, texted me during the game, his team Liverpool in a title race with Arsenal. And he asked me, is Chelsea throwing this game on purpose? I found it hard to defend Chelsea in that situation. It was one of the worst performances I've seen in all my time watching this club. And then, yeah, go down 2-0 to Villa, and it's like, oh God, here's more of the same. I will give credit where credit is due. Poch made the adjustment there. He went to the three at the back. I also liked it. I think this team is more comfortable playing it. I played it for a very long time. I know we have a pretty much brand new set of players from the last time we consistently played it. But as a club, we typically do well with the five at the back. It was nice to see that change. It was nice to see a change that positively affected the game. That being said, I'm a little bit more down on that Villa match than you are. I saw it as lost points. That first half was just so terrible. It was not good. We did not come back in that game. We blew that game, in my opinion. And as you get, I know we have a young team, we have an inexperienced team, but as you get down to the wire here, what do we have? 5 matches left. You have to tighten things up in these matches. But it did lead an interesting question in my head. Lead to an interesting question in my head. You know, you look at the table, Villa in fourth, Spurs in fifth, United in sixth, and Newcastle, West Ham, and us. I don't think we're on the same level as the top three, Arsenal, City, Liverpool. But, you know, without any matches played, just looking at the team on paper, where does Chelsea fit in the Premier League? If you were to do like a preseason ranking almost, where would you put Chelsea in that hierarchy?
I want to make sure I understand your question correctly. Are we talking preseason, or are we talking like current form, like, or like?
So erase all the results we've had this year. So in effect, a preseason ranking. You just look at it, you look at the squads.
Right? Our squad today, not day one. If you were to rank the teams today, it's season starts today.
Yes.
Preseason for next season, right? That's what you're thinking.
Yep.
Yeah. I think we are sixth.
Yeah.
I think it's City, Arsenal, Liverpool. And then I think a Tottenham would sit above us today. But I don't think Villa does.
I don't think so either. I think we're fifth. And it again, I know it's a new squad. I know it's a young squad. I know it's a first-year manager. But it's been a season of underperforming. And I know it's been a tale of two halves, right? But this team should be battling for at least a Europa League spot, if not in the mix, to sneak into a top four. They are better than Villa. They are better than United. Newcastle's a train wreck, and West Ham got off to a hot start and has faded. Mm-hmm.
I think that's what the frustration around the season like boils down to, is we've seen the moments, we've seen us play decently well against the top six, and for our name to not be included in the top six, you know, hurts. Like, it just, it kind of stings. And we've, you know, when I look at the season as a whole, it's the loss against Wolves and then the loss against Wolves that destroy our season. That can't happen. That's a draw and a win. That's 4 points lost. Like any other season, that's 4 points, and we lost both of those games, man. It's pretty unacceptable. And the underperformance against Burnley and Sheffield, like the two draws the second time around, you know, those are drop points, and those are the moments that you kick yourself over as players, and the ones that you look back on.
Yeah, I mean, just those games alone is what, an extra 8 points? It would put us in sixth ahead of United.
Yeah.
But like I said, tale of two halves. Has this been a successful second half for you?
Yeah, I'm really happy you brought this up, because I brought the stats to back up my argument here, which I don't always come loaded with. But so the first half of the season, we had 7 wins, 4 draws, 8 losses. It's a total of 25 points. Not a great first half of the season by any stretch of the imagination. So that's a full, you know, the full gamut of games. Second half, we have 6 wins, 5 draws, 3 losses, just 23 points with 5 games to play. So for those at home, that is 2 points less than the first half of the season with 5 in hand. I think that we surpassed that by a decent margin. And I think it shows clear development half over half for our season. I think it shows a lot of progress. And I think, you know, optimistically, we play Tottenham, which is going to be a tough one. That's our next match. We play West Ham, we play Brighton, we play Bournemouth, and we play Forest. So if we, let's just say we win 2, draw 2, lose 2, that's 6, 8 points. That puts us at 31 points. That's 6 points more than we had in the first half. I mean, that's relatively significant improvement, half over half. We've seen a lot of solidification, if I'm going to make up a word here, of the squad. We've seen development in a good amount of players. One thing I was going to bring up about the Villa match, just very as a quick aside, we realized how much we missed Malagusto in that match. Holy shit, do we realize how much we missed Malagusto, because we were not anywhere close to dynamic down that right side. We spent a lot more time on the left, which kind of showed that we weren't great on the left as much as we were on the right. But anywho, You know, I think the ability to pivot where we were to where we are to where we could be with, you know, maybe one signing. I don't think this team is six signings away from being great. I think this team is one and a half, two signings away from being top four contenders. It's kind of how I look at us. Shown improvement. We're on a good track. We've had hiccups, but I think that's part of the recipe when you have a U21 team is hiccups. That's to be expected with that young of a squad. Every single year of this project from here on out is a year more solidified, more away from being a U21 team, more playing together. And I think it really could work.
Yeah, and I'm curious what your two signings, one and a half signings are that improve this team, because I could point to a number of areas where we could use improvement. And since I've thought that, I've also put a couple places or pieces in place that we're getting back from loans, right? So you're going to have Andre Santos, who has been fantastic at Strasbourg since joining up. He'll be coming in, even if Connor Gallagher is sold. I think your midfield is pretty solid there. Your wing is another option where you need something. You got Angelo coming back. He's dropped off a little bit at Strasbourg, but you know he still looks to be at least, I would say, on the same level as Noni Madueke. So what are your one and a half, two signings where you're improving this team?
I think we need, and now as I say this out loud, so I'm going to make the argument that we're okay at center back for now.
If we're fully healthy.
That's kind of my assumption, because between Wes Fofana, Levi Colwell, Axel Disasi, I think we're okay. I think one of our signings probably comes at left back, but that's because of exits going. So I think one of, or if not both of, Benny Chills and Cucurella go. So I think we might make a signing there. I think we're good in the middle triangle of our pitch. I think we make at least a depth signing at striker. If it's not an Osimhen, like it's not a big name striker, we need another fucking body as a striker because we don't have anybody. So I would say, here's what I would say. I would say if we signed a left back and a striker, we are pretty damn close. That's what I'll say. I think you can also make the argument for a left wing because of Mudryk's inconsistency and Sterling's lack of effort. So between the two of them, we probably need help. So there's my two and a half. I'll give you that.
Yeah, I like the left back. I'm not sure it happens, though. I don't know who we have coming through the ranks, but I agree one of Chilwell or Cucurella, if not both, will be gone. But it wouldn't then surprise me to see them try to flip Malo Gusto over to that side or keep Levi Colwell over there. We might be priced out on striker. I don't know who you sign. But it's not going to be an Osimhen. I would like Benjamin Sesko. That would be fantastic, but I think we're going to be priced out of him as well. So I think you got to run with Nico Jackson. Armando Broya has to be, his playing career has to be done at this point. He can't even get on the pitch right now for Fulham. So he's coming back. He's not going to do anything. Dr. Fofana, I think, is a solid backup, still very raw. But I think that, yeah, probably a depth piece at striker is probably the best bet. Somebody who is Premier League experienced, like a Demba Ba signing or a Samuel Eto'o signing would be fantastic. I just don't know who's out there. And I'm not convinced on the keeper. I think you need an established keeper. Petrovic could be a good starter down the road, but he's young. We've seen him regress back to the mean. that's all because keepers develop late, right? So by the time he's 28, 29, he'll be fine, but he's young for a keeper. Robert Sanchez is young too. And I think he has the build of a keeper. He's big, tall. He can, you know, he can get out there and stop shots, but his distribution is terrible. So between one of those two, they'll be keeper of the future. But yeah, I think you need somebody experienced back between the sticks.
I think what this whole debate has done is just shined a light on how spoiled we were to have Petrček for as long as we had Petrček, to have established, reliable, phenomenal, world-class game saver. I could go on and on and on about how great Petrček was. And when you don't have that, it sucks. It just really, really sucks. I don't mind that shout at all, because I think Petrovic has been fine, but not phenomenal. So he doesn't make as many mistakes, but he does not make as many stops that, again, my eye test for keepers is, do you make stops every once in a while that I was like, how the hell did you make that stop? And he doesn't do that. And we do have a keeper coming back from loan, though. So we'll see what happens there.
That was going to be my next question. Last week, or maybe 2 weeks ago, we talked about Rahm possibly coming back as a striker, since we have no money. Do you give Kepa a shot at winning that, or do you just offload him?
I think you give him a shot. I don't know why not. You let him compete for it. I don't see why not. I don't know what happened to him at Madrid. Did he get hurt? Do you know the story of?
So he was the starter to start the season. They've got Andre Lunin, who the Ukrainian, who's been their prospect for a while. So he was making cup starts and playing real well. Well, Kepa picked up an injury for a couple weeks, and essentially lost his spot after that, with Lunin playing so well. And then I'm sure there was some kind of clause in that loan contract. He plays X amount of minutes, you got to pay us more, something like that, because Ancelotti has shut Kepa down basically for the rest of the season at this point.
And it looked like he played almost like exactly half of the season. Like he played almost half the minutes, half the cup, whatever. What I do think like Kepa still brings to the table is when you watch that City versus Madrid penalty shootout, dude's still spot on with what his knowledge is on PKs. Also, shout out to Rudiger for knowing which way Kovacic is going to go. That was hilarious. Absolute memes. And then Rudiger taking the winning penalty in that match just was like the fucking cherry on top of the cake, man. It was just absolutely hilarious for me. But I digress. I think Kepa's still a really solid, you know, prospect for us. You have to evaluate all options for us with financial fair play and rules around who we can bring in, where we want to spend our money on. He's still a top quality keeper. So I think he needs to be evaluated. Similar with Rahm, I think we need to evaluate it as an option. But if I'm a betting man, I'm more optimistic that Kepa comes in and makes more starts than Rahm does, just due to attitude and willingness to be here. I also did read that more than a couple of Saudi clubs are still very interested in Rahm. So there's still smoke around his name as a big name for a Saudi club to bring in. So we still might be able to scrounge some money for him, which would be dynamite if you ask me.
Let's think. PSR is dead at the end of the year. New rules voted in. I believe it's, you can spend 35% or 40% or something of the lowest club's TV revenue. There's been all kinds of accounts on X, some good, some not, evaluating where every Premier League club is within those financial restraints. Chelsea, the only club to abstain from voting, is also the only club that would fail to meet those targets, about £32 million over the quote-unquote cap. So I think that leads to some interesting questions in regards to a Kepa, a Rahm, even a Raheem Sterling, and some homegrown players of who do you sell so that you're not getting hit with points deductions?
You know, we've seen a really big amount of deadwood get sold off this team in the last 12 months. We still have a little bit more. So I think the Rahms and the Raheems and the Ziyeches of the world still can get, you know, offloaded and raise some money. If you have to, I hate to say this, you have to sell Baba Rahman, I would.
Malang Sarr.
Malang Sarr, those types of names that still kind of float around and just exist on a piece of paper, and they're probably a burner account from someone on Twitter. It's a tax write-off somewhere, man. I don't know. I'm still convinced that Romeo Lavia doesn't exist as a human. So, I think we still have the ability to comply with rules, especially considering where our wages were 2 seasons ago versus where they are today. And the long-term deals that we put in place at lower wage structure, I think makes a lot of sense. I'm not up to date on all of the rules of how all this works, but I think we would have the ability to kind of comply and get into line with some of those rules. I know we don't today, but we have some time to fix some things and sell some things around. I think the bigger thing is most Chelsea fans are going to, you know, lick their chops and kind of go, who can we buy this year? You know, who can we buy in this transfer window? That might get thwarted in a big way. We might need to work with what we have, which I don't think is the worst thing in the world. Think back to transfer ban, bring up the academy players and find a Reece James, right? Like, think back to those times where you kind of got to work with what you got. I think there could be a lot of success in that. And I think the team that we have is raw and good and has a lot of promise. One player that I really wanted to shout out that I don't know if you caught this to the same degree I did, but I thought Moises Caicedo had a phenomenal game against Villa. I thought he balled out. And I was just really excited to see him, who was a bit shaky on his entry into Chelsea. He's can't drop territory. Whereas Enzo, I know he's injured now and had his surgery and stuff, so it's a little bit different. But like, Enzo is kind of getting cycled out. Caicedo's in the can't drop territory, and he absolutely balled out. So like, some of these guys I'm starting to see like, ooh, this could get fun. This could, if we have him for 4 years, like, this could be really fun.
Well, and so outside of Caicedo, I appreciate that shout because he's gotten a lot of unjust hate this year. I think it's just a lot of people are like Matt, who I'm going to pick on for not being on the pod. Just don't understand that role. They don't understand that holding mid, that pivot role. Because he's been great, you know, for the better part of three quarters of this season. But you know, outside of him, a big money signing, our best signings have been in that $20 to $40 million range. And so, you know, if we can offload, and I know you guys hate this, but Connor Gallagher, 60 mil, you know, you can get something for Chilwell or Cucurella. You can sell Kepa, Rahm, you know, possibly get something for Raheem Sterling. We'll see. But you know, you can bring in 3, 4, maybe 5 players for, you know, a nice little chunk of change, but not, you know, record breaking transfers every goddamn window. And bring in somebody like a Nico Jackson, bring in somebody like an Andre Santos, like a Malo Gusto, you know, some of these kind of unheralded players who have something to fight for.
If we can do that, man, it would be fantastic, because you're spot on. Like, Malo Gusto has been literally one of our best signings. I know part of that's due to Reese's injuries and him getting a chance to show and shine and show out. But like, him and Cole Palmer have been great. Medweke has been hit miss, but he does bring something to the team, which is a level of finishing that it reminds me of. Like, his finishing reminds me of like Pedro, where he finishes when it counts and he takes his shots when it counts. not the same player by any stretch of the imagination, but like he's going to probably score about as many goals as Pedro did, which is needed on the team. He's got the attacking mindset of Willian, and you know, he just wants to go, and I get it, but like, you know, we need players like that. And I agree, we've got pieces that we can move around. I think when it's all said and done, Gallagher is either probably going to get sold and, you know, cashed in, if you want to call it that, or he is going to go down as a club legend, because he has a chance to captain this team for the foreseeable, right? For 5, 6, 7 years, and be like the, I've done this now for 5 years and I can really show people who's boss. He needs to be more assertive. I saw again, there was a bit of a scruff with the refereeing at the end of that Villa match. Again, Conor Gallagher wasn't seen holding his players back or kind of getting in the middle of it. And again, I was like, dude, you got to control your team. Like, you got to be that guy to step in and say, like, this ain't all right. Or the guy who's fighting it, right? Like, the guy who's in the ref's ear, right? You either have to be one or the other, because you can't be a bystander when that shit's going on. And I hear you when you say that, and I agree with that. I'll criticize when needed.
Yeah, shout out to our guy Joe. You got to be either the James Milner or the Jordan Henderson as a captain. You can't be an in between. But I just looked at our signings from this past summer. So you got three above, we'll say, 50 million pounds, and then the next three below that. So your three big signings this summer: Caicedo, fantastic. Lavia, we don't know if that's a real person. And Kunku, almost the same boat as Lavia.
Legit, but not, right?
Next three, the under 40 million pounds: Cole Palmer, player of the season. Axel Disasi, I think he still has the most minutes played on the team. And Nicholas Jackson, who has been our first striker to notch double-digit goals in, I don't know, 4 years, 5 years.
Passes the eye test, but still young and unproven.
Timo Werner. So, yeah, it definitely our better business is done in that mid-range. All right, well, we got 5 matches to go. I know we've done this segment the last 3 weeks, but it changes every single week. Where do we finish after these 5 matches? How many points do we take away from these last 5?
I would be happy with 11. So 15 total, right? Yep. Available. This is just where my optimism strikes in. And like my realist hat is off and my optimism hat's on. Like, the only loss is Tottenham, and then everything else should be winnable. That's how I look at this team. If we get something from Tottenham, great. We beat them first time around, sure. They're fighting, I get it. But like, even if we lose that, I think everything else is winnable. I really do. So that would be 12. So I'll say 10 is a win.
I understand where you're coming from. Absolutely. But you know me, I'm reactionary. This past week, I could see this going, you know, a Frank Lampard special here, not winning another match the rest of the season. Spurs, they're fighting for the Champions League. Could be an L. West Ham, London Derby, who the hell knows? Forest is fighting to stay up. Brighton hates us. And Bournemouth is riding high, most points they've ever scored in the top division ever. I agree. 10 would be great, but I could see it going as low as 2.
2 would be rough. 2 would equal the amount of points that we had in the first half of the season. It'd be 25 in the first, 25 in the second.
Perfectly balanced.
I mean, that would be bad, right? Like if that happened, it would be not good. I feel like we have to beat Brighton just because they're a little brother. We got to stick it to little brother. So there's three right there.
So that would, so 2 points, the 2 point minimum would put us 6 points above last year's finish. Another segment we do every week now. Is that enough to save Pochettino's job?
I would say it would be really a tough to end this season with 2 points out of your last five, or better said, 3 points out of your last six, because if you go back a match, 3 points out of your last seven, because you go back two matches. How's that? So that would be a really, really, really tough way to end the season. So that's grounds for getting fired. I think that would get you shot.
Does 10 points preserve his job?
I think so. I think 10 points shows progress. I think 10 points shows progress points year over year. I think 10 points shows progress first half over second half, because you have 25 points and you have 33 points in the second half of the season. That's measurable progress to me. And when you look at like the top six, so first time we played City, I'll go down the list. First time we played all of these guys versus the second time, and the only one we don't have two sample sizes for is Tottenham. First time we played City, we drew. Arsenal draw, Liverpool draw, Villa loss, Tottenham win, Newcastle loss. City we drew again, Arsenal we lost, that drubbing we talked about. Liverpool we lost, but that was an 87th minute Virgil goal. Very, very closely contested. So those two are both like, or that one, excuse me, close to a draw. Villa, we lost the first time. We drew second time. That was the game we just played. Tottenham, we won the first time. Don't know the second time yet. And then Newcastle lost first time, win second time. We've got a decent record against the top six. But then when you like go down the route, the rest of the 14, we've done pretty much better from the first time to the second time. After that, like we've improved our result in almost every single situation. So I see progress. Like that's to me empirical progress. Again, with hiccups, but still progress.
See, and I think a loss to Spurs on Thursday might seal it. They may not sack him until the end of the season, because I don't think they want to make the same mistake they made last year. But I think the situation with the fan base will become untenable. You know, losing to Arsenal as bad as we did, losing in the FA Cup semifinal to City, and then losing to another rival in Tottenham, all in quick succession. I don't see him surviving that if that happens. But we've seen that derby go many directions, so who knows.
I hear you, and I hear like the fan reaction to that, which might happen, right? Like, but I guess we'll have that conversation next week when we know the result. And then I will ask you, if it's not Poch, who is it, and what are they going to do differently with the squad that they have to get better results? Because I think that's a fair question and a fair point to bring up, but we will save that for next week.
I like it. All right. Well, with that cliffhanger, make sure to listen next week to the Flag Stays Down podcast. Maybe we'll have a full house, but tonight it was Parker and myself. We're doing the end of intro or end of episode introductions here. Make sure to subscribe, rate, and review. Turn those notifications on. I think some of those things have that, but turn that on so you know when next week's episode comes out. And make sure to follow us on social media at FlagDownPod. So, Parker, been a pleasure like always. And hopefully next week we're talking about some wins.
I would like that. It'd be great.
Cheers.
Cheers, bud.